Interview of Mr. Lambert, 80 Seam Street, Holmesville. Mr. Lambert, when did the depression start?
Well, I was going to say, looking back over the years since the depression, one can say that the depression of the 30s actually commenced as early as 1923. At this time, there was a very serious slump in all industries, coal trades, and industries in general. And even in back as far as 23, as I say, the mines in this area started to close. Now, West Wall's End Quarry closed. It actually closed on 14/9/23. The J&A Brown Collieries, Back Creek, and New Tunnel closed in 1924. That was at Minmay. The Cooperative Colliery at Wall's End closed in 1925. And many others in our area was only working broken time, such as 5, maybe 6 days per fortnight. Fortnightly, we was paid fortnightly in those days. Conditions in the mining industry gradually grew worse until 1929, when the mine owners, led by coal baron John Brown, demanded a reduction of 12.5% in all contract wages and a shilling a day in all day wage rates, like daily rates. The miners refused to accept this, so the coal owners closed their mines. It was only the coal owners who belonged to the Coal Owners Association who closed their mines. There were many people... Turn it up, please. There was many owners of the mines who were not in the Coal Owners Association, and they worked their mines. So there were a few people about this area working when the lockout went. Now, this lockout started on the 1st of the 3rd month, 1929, and it carried on until the 2nd of June, 1930. See, the mines in our area, where we included West Wall's End, it was closed in 23. CM number 1, there was 420-odd men out of work. CM number 2, 500 men were out of work. Cubby, 450 men out of work. And Rhonda, 140 at least. Well, then there was other mines in close areas of men living in Westie, all out of work. Well, now West Wall's End, it was still staggering under the effects of the lockout. When the lockout finished, although the conditions were guaranteed by the coal owners that all pits would reopen on full employment, less the 12.5%, and although these pits opened, they just didn't work. There was no coal trade. There was no trade for them. And conditions gradually worsened until the depression came in. Its worst time, I would say, would be from 1931 to about 36, and conditions slightly lifted in then.
How much was the dole?
Well, the dole was a single man received 5 and 3 pence per week, and a married man received 8 and 2 pence. The married man received added allowances for each child that he had, which generally worked out at approximately 1 and 7 pence per week per child. Well, put that into today's decimal currency, and you'd have 53 cents for the single man, 82 cents for the married man, and 17 cents per week for the child. Well, now, to get this dole, one must be unemployed for 14 days before making an application. And after a 14 days further, the dole was paid if you was really more or less destitute. The reason for the 14 days was we were paid fortnightly. in those days, and the mines always held at least 1 week's pay in hand. So that meant you had to be at least 14 days without any money. Now the first dole I can recall being paid, that's to me, was late in 1931, as I was employed until then. I am unable to find out, actually, when the dole started in New South Wales, but I have read that the dole was paid in Victoria in 1930. So perhaps New South Wales started paying at the same time. Well now, this dole, it was supposed to buy for the person. I have a Newcastle Herald cutting to cover this statement I make now. The dole, or the five and threepence, and it says here that although this was accepted in New South Wales, it may not have been accepted throughout the other states. Well, now, a single man's dole, it bought him 3 loaves of bread, 4 ounces of tea, 8 ounces of butter, 16 ounces of sugar, 12 ounces of jam, 1 shilling's worth of meat, that would be 10 cents worth of meat, and half a bar of soap. Now evidently the woman, or the married woman, didn't have to eat, because all she got was 4 loaves of bread, that was one added loaf. She got 6 ounces of tea, 8 ounces of butter, 2 tins of milk, that's condensed, 24 ounces of jam, 1 shilling's worth of oatmeal, half a bar of soap, and 1 and fourpence worth of meat. Total, 8 and tuppence. And to get this dole, you had to be totally destitute. Because the first questions that asked you were, did you have any money in the bank? Any money in stocks, shares, bonds, or any money in the cooperative store? In other words, you had to be totally destitute before you could receive it. If a brother or a son of the family worked, there was no dole for the parents. Many single men, myself included, had to leave home to get this dole. The reason I left home was because my father said that he felt as if he had to lower his dignity to apply for the dole, so he built up a small poultry farm with a few pounds that he had in the bank. After 12 or 18 months, this money in the bank did him no good because the banks closed and you could not withdraw your money. Now the banks closed on the 13th of the 4th, 1931, and reopened on the 19th of the 2nd, 1932. Right. You ask the question.
Mr. Lambert, how were the food vouchers used?
Well, you always received the food voucher in 3 sections for a single man, 4 sections for a married man. The sections were made out for the single meat, groceries and bread. And the 4th section for the married people was milk. Meat, groceries, bread and milk. Well, in the first place, when it started to be issued, the police used to issue it. Some towns, many towns, the police station itself. But in West Wall's End, we received ours at the School of Arts. Well, the docket was always made out to some particular firm. Well, I had mine, and many people had theirs, made out to the Co-op Society at West Wall's End. And when you'd go and spend it, any portion not spent was always entered into a book as credit. Say, whatever the person's name be, might be Joe Shaw, credit 2 and 6, or whatever the name may be. Well, now, there was a lot of arguments over this as the amount of credit that was left. So it was later on, about 1931 late, the West Wall's End Cooperative Store made a type of a false money. The false money was You had a halfpenny and penny made out of copper. The sixpence was made out of brass. The sixpence and shilling was made out of aluminium. And right on the, printed in the back of these coins was West Walls Inn Co-op Society. Well, now, any credit or unspent portion of your docket, that was paid back to you in this money. Well, now, that made certain that the money was, you couldn't be spent anywhere else bar the Cooperative Society. And they got all the business. Well, now, in the first place where the police was giving the dole out, they were very harsh in their treatment to people. They would browbeat poor, inoffensive women, and many personally refused. Well, I don't know on what grounds, but they were just refused. I could tell a lot of stories about that. But then later on, about 32, middle of 32, the Works Department, or the government took it over, and they sent out, we'll say, public servants, and they paid it. Well, now, the dole, in my estimation, wasn't any easier to get. You still have the same questions and the same conditions to fulfil, but there was much more civility. The people didn't treat you like animals. Well, then, later on, we started to work for the dole. Minmai, or Taro Shire, started in the middle of 1933, and the West Walls End under Lake Macquarie Shire started in November 1933.
What was it like working in the mines?
Well, conditions in the mines in those days wasn't as good as they are today. Through accidents and explosions, conditions such as air, working conditions and many other things are much better today. The coal was actually got by hand method. That is, the holes were bored into the coal and explosives put in and fired and then filled into skips, transported to the surface in skips, not on a belt as today. I think mining would be roughly as safe in those days as it is today. Accidents were averaged on production coal produce, deaths per 1,000 tons, and it averaged less than 3 tons, it averaged about the same as today. Now, production overall over the men employed in pit averaged less than 3 tons per man overall throughout a colliery. Now, take Seam Colliery out in number 2. At its best, men and boys employed, and put out 1,300 tons a day. Pitt, using mechanical methods, produced sometimes 30 to 50 tons per man. And you can see what Seam did. Besides that, in my day, most mines in the 1930s employed quite a lot of men for small production. And taken overall, there was 23,000 men in the Miners' Federation, and now there's only about 13,000, and they're producing, well, hundreds of times more tons of coal. See, with their open cut and their and the methods.
How much is paid to each miner?
Well, the miners worked contract on the contract system. They received so much per ton for the ewing rate, and they had a dag on, or a darg as it was called, that allowed a pair of men to fill so many skips per day, and it also created an even distribution of skips throughout the pit by allowing everybody the same amount of skips. Well, people on a close haul from the shaft bottom could get skips easier than people working, say, three parts of a mile away. Well, miners were contract, wheelers were generally contract, and the rest of them, the people about the mines, was day wage. Now, starting at 14 years, you started in the industry at 14, you received in my day 6 and a penny per shift. And that rose at the rate of about 1 and 8 pence to 1 and 10 pence per day till you got to 18. Then it rose in bigger amounts till when you reached man status, you received a pound and 6 pence per day. Shiftmen in the mines, they got a pound and 6 pence. Offhand labour on the surface was never paid a great deal. They only got about 18 bob a day. That's the payment on them. Miners in those days, I've seen many miners would earn, we'll say, well over £2 a day, and it was big money in them days, but today's it's nothing.
What kind of medical treatment was available?
Well, I think in those days the medical treatment was really good. If anything, it was just as good as the treatment you get. Of course, medicine has advanced. We'll give all that in, and there's probably more diseases covered now. But the average person, a worker, it was medical and all that was deducted from his pay at the place he worked at. Now, each worker paid at the office, or paid, I think it was 1 and 3 pence per week. That would run about 14 bob a quarter. The eye doctor, you paid him 3 pence per week. Hospital, you paid 6 pence per week. And the ambulance, you paid 3 pence per week. And for these, you'd go to the doctor any time you liked, call him out any time you liked, day or night, and you paid no more. If you were sick and wanted medicine, he mixed his own medicine. He generally employed a dispenser. Now the eye doctor, if you had anything wrong with your eyes, you'd go and see him, and that would also cover a pair of glasses made occasionally. I don't know how often you could buy glasses. And I think myself that well, summing up the way some of the doctors are flying up now, I think the medical service or the availability to treatment to the patient was even better than it is today, because in many cases you can't get much treatment today often.
What kind of washing facilities were used?
Well, they were pretty rough for the, but not compared with today. But what seemed to be the standard thing in those days? You washed by hand on a washing board. Well, the washing board, it was just a frame, and it had a sort of a rippled glass in it. It was rippled. And you'd grab the clothes and you'd rub them up and down till you nearly wore holes in them. Well, 90% of the materials were boiled. If you was lucky, you had a copper, a proper copper set in a cast iron frame, with a little chimney up the back of it. But if you was not too well off, you generally had a couple of kerosene tins sitting over an open fire built on bricks out in the yard. Well, that's where you did most of your boiling. Well, there was very few washing powders, if any. Small pieces of soap were saved and was shaved or scraped into the copper, plus a bit of washing soda. Now, the washing soda seemed to be one of the mainstays for getting the dirt out. Well, when they were washed and boiled, you'd rinse them, and you always had a spare tub out on the side. This was all done in a round tub. Not cement tubs. If you were well off, you'd have cement tubs and water over it, and a wash out. But a lot of people just washed out in the yard. Well, then you would rinse them in water and Ricketts Blue. They were supposed to whiten them. And put them out and run the risk whether you got a blow or not.
Did the women ever cut their hands on the glass?
Oh, it was very seldom unless it broke. Well, now, before the glass came out, they used to have a one made of zinc. like a thin sheet zinc, but it was still rippled the same as a bore, the glass one. And now and again, that zinc would crack across one of the ripples, and before you knew it, you'd rip holes in perhaps half a dozen articles. You'd be washing away then. Just wring them out and put them in. Well, that used to rip the clothes, you know, badly at times, these zinc ones.
What was transport like?
Well, in my days, there was very few motor cars. There was odd ones about the town. But I would say that in West Wall's End, it would be lucky if there were seven or eight motor cars in West Wall's End and Hunsville. Most travel was done in horse and sulky, or a bike. Well, failing those two, you had to walk. Well, there was a tram service to West Wall's End, and a train service from the passenger service from down at near the football ground of today. Well, the tram service, it started at West Wall's End, from Wall's End to West Wall's End, on the 9th of the 12th, 1910. And it finished running on the 2nd of the 11th month, 1930. Well, now, a grown-up person could get in the tram and go to Wall's End, it cost him 4 pence, that'd be 4 cents. Well, now they had a train service there too. Well, it was established very early through the West Wall's End Coal Company, about 1895 I think it was fully established. There had been one or two slight attempts to run before that, and it went on until the 13th of the 1st, 1930. And it was stopped more or less at the request of some of the union officials, miners' union officials, that was stopped thinking that the companies was making profit out of it. This was during the lockout. And they were told that if they stopped it, it would never be started again. Well, it never started again. Now, about the same time as the passenger service started, they started a goods service. That's for bringing goods to the West Wall's End store and different other stores in the area. Well, now, that stopped during the lockout, but it carried on after the lockout. It started again, it carried on till the 11th of November 1938. Well, when the tram stopped, Young and Green put over a service with buses, and it used to cost you 3 bob from Westie to the Newcastle Railway Station, right in. Well then, shortly after that, the government came out and they stopped the through service to Newcastle and allowed the buses to run from West Wall's End to Wall's End to meet the government trams there. And they called them feeder buses. Well, the transport was, it ran a good hourly service, the tram, of the daytime. Its first tram came in at 6 o'clock, went out at 6:30, in at 7:30, went out at 8, and so on. And the last tram went out at 11 o'clock of the night. Now the train, it left the station at 7 o'clock to Copper Creek Railway Station, and it came back and at 8:30 in the morning. It left again at 5 o'clock in the evening, and it came back at 6:30 in the evening. So services wasn't too bad even in them days.
I've just got one question. What was the condition of the transport like the interior and everything?
Oh, well, I've got to say, we used to call, the trams, they were just a series of seats side by side. You could shut the door and make them weatherproof. It wasn't like riding on the back of a truck out in the open. The trains was what we called the old dog box type. And I know they had cleaners to clean Westie Pit. They had cleaners to clean the carriages. And they was kept in very reasonable condition.
What did the people of the community do for entertainment?
Well, before the Depression came in, there was two picture shows in Westy. There was one on the corner of Carrington and Laidley Street. There was another one in Carrington Street, the Strand, it was. Now, the bottom picture show, as we called it, I don't know what it was called. That was the one on the corner of Laidley and Carrington Street. Well, during the Depression, that show shut. But the top show, it showed pictures on a Monday, a Wednesday, Friday and Saturday nights. I was going to say the attendance to these shows was controlled by the amount of days the miners worked, because if you went up and you saw the picture shows nice and full, well, you could say the pits were working good time. If they're only about half full, well, you'd say the pits were only working, you know, 5 or 6 days a fortnight. Well, now, there was always a dance or two in the town, either at the Federal Hall or down at the Museum Hall. Well, they were never very dear to go to. You could always go to them for about sixpence. And then as the Depression came on and really settled in, you could go down to... The charge was never more than sixpence. And very often they threw a feed in with it, a couple of sandwiches. So you give a dance, a feed and a fight all in the one night for sixpence. But there wasn't much fighting about it. Things was pretty well controlled. And they made, in the Depression, they made a lot of their own fun. They had to, by holding house parties and different sports days. None of these things cost you any money to go to. They put on a heap of dog racing, foxy dog racing and cattle dog racing. They went on every Sunday. And, you know, I've seen as high as we're seeing up to 400 people or more at where these dog races were being held. They'd have a bookmaker there too, and you could always bet in a shilling or two, but never no big bets.
What kind of clothing was worn then, and what was it made from?
Oh, I'd say the normal conventional clothing of today was made. It was the same as made today. Their dresses for the women was worn much longer. Then round about in the 25s to 30, the younger people, the flappers as they called the young girls in that day, they got dresses, we'll say, just about their knee, very tight. I'd say they were made mostly of cotton or woolen materials, because there was very few synthetics that I can recall. Very, very few. But I would say that the clothes were just as serviceable then as it is today. Men, way back about 20, that's the older men, they wore pants, very thin leg, more or less a sort of a stovepipe pants, as we used to call them. But I know when I was, say, in the 30s to 34 or 5, going about dances, the pants you wore was, you could have them up to what they called 24 inch. That meant that the pants folded, or the leg was 12 inches, you know, wide. But I never ever got them that wide. 20 inch would do me. That's as high as ever I got to. And the coats were shorter. Instead of the coat being well down, just come round about your hip pocket, a little short coat. But I've got to say, this would be a question my wife could answer better than me. So I really don't know much about it.
What was the schooling like?
Oh, well, I reckon the school would be about the same today. You always had the teacher. But in our day, I've often thought that the teacher that we had, I think he lacked a sense of humour. Because in my last year at school, that was the eighth class we called it then, I was 14, our teacher was a Mr. Moore. And no matter what you did wrong, he always had a big cane that he called Little Jacob. This thing was about 3 feet long and 1/2 inch diameter. And if you stepped out of line, you got that pretty savagely. Well, I think that's cut out today. Good for it. Any sums you got wrong during the arithmetic lesson, you had to stay behind school of a night and get them right. Do them to get them right. And outside of that, well, I know I used to often get into trouble, or other people got into trouble, because when we get out in the quadrangle, he called it, that was the tarred surface, people were generally that poor, even in my day, as it's before the Depression, when the pits only worked 3 and 4 and 6 or 7 days a fortnight, you'd go to school with no boots on. Well, standing out there in 105 degree heat, and the asphalt underneath you was melting, you'd be standing and shifting your feet about. Well, if you saw you move, you'd get tuppence you sent into school and you'd get a couple of cuts with a cane. But I think he had more, or thought he had more power than Hitler, the way he used to dictate to us. But there's one thing I'll give him to his credit, he was really a good teacher. Because it paid you to learn and listen to him. But the last part of my schooling, I went back there. See, I'd turned 14 in 1926. And when I went back to school after the year, I only poked about, more or less doing nothing. I'd go to school for a couple of days, then I might lose school and go looking for a job. And this went on for about a month or 6 weeks, and all I did was put palings on the outside fence and do a few jobs about the school, so I finally left. Well, I say that'll be the finish of my school days.
Were there any sheltered areas in the quadrangle, or did you have to stand there?
We had what we called a basement. Now, the basement today, I think it's been made into a room, like. It was immediately under the head teacher's teaching room, and the area that was there was, say, might have been 30-35 feet, be about 15. It wasn't big enough to house quarter of the kids that was in Westie School. That's the only shelter we had. Otherwise, you might go into the school room and you'd just have to sit there and behave yourself. If it rained, so you had practically no shelter.
I reckon that's free warranty till night.
What were the housing facilities like?
Well, I don't think that there was ever a great number of rented houses in West Wall's End. Most of the people seemed to own their own. Well, the house, seems to me to be generally consisted of, say, 4 rooms, back and front veranda, mostly pretty well of the same shape, because it's not like today. You've got hundreds of designs today that people can build on. Well, see, you take this place of mine. I can remember it being built. It was built in 1927 by the Rural Bank. And people came for miles to see it, because it was a new style of a house with a big bay fronted and that in the front of it. But they were generally constructed of weatherboard and iron, lined with lining boards inside. In general, I think they was equal to any other mining town, the houses in West Wall's End.
How many people were religious?
Well, Westy, to my reckoning, was never very religious. Of course, you had the many of the older people. They went to church regularly every Sunday. They were what you'd call old stalwarts or diehards. The church has put on a Sunday school class for the children of a Sunday. And I think in those days the churches was better patronised than they are today, because the younger people of today doesn't seem to go to church like the older or the younger people of my days. But I can assure you the only reason I went to church in Sunday school was because I was sent. I had no choice. I don't know whether it did me any good or not, but...
When did the Depression ease, and what sort of jobs were available before the Depression?
Well, we'll take before the Depression first. Well, about in this town, West Wall's End, the only jobs, or most of the jobs that offered, was in the mines. Well, there was the accepted thing that the son follow his father into the mines. And when you turned 14, your father started to ask for a job for you. Well, if your father worked in Seam Pit, you'd probably get a job in Seam Pit. And it was only on very rare occasions that if your father worked in Seam Pit, that if you could get a job in Killypin, because they more or less catered for their workers' sons. Well, there was a few people used to travel to town, to the BHP, but now the year I left school, there was two of a class, I'll say of 30 boys of us, there was two of them got apprenticeships out of, see, as I said, the Depression was just, you know, on its way in, 27 and getting worse, the lockout. Well, there was only two apprenticeships out of a set of 30 boys that left. The rest would find their way into the pits. Now, what was the other part of the question?
When did the Depression ease?
To my way of thinking, I think the first signs of the Depression lifting would be around about 1936. About 36. There was odd people getting jobs about. In fact, I said, I know I got one in 1936 myself. But that would be about the first signs. Yeah.
If people were employed, were their wages generally enough for them to live comfortably?
Well, I don't know whether you'd say their wages were enough to live comfortable. The wages were such that you just had to live on it. Now, the basic wage in my day, they call it the minimum wage today, it was set way back in about 1910 or 11 by a Mr. Justice Higgins. And he worked out where a man, his wife, and one child could live on a certain amount of money. Whether there was any allowances for medical, entertainment, or anything other than that, that's what he worked out. Well, now this basic wage, it went on, well, it went on until, I'd say right up now, and they call it the minimum wage. And to my way of thinking, no matter what the basic wage was, the cost of living was always one jump in front of it. And people just had to exist on it. Well, now you take today. People on the minimum wage, unless they're paying for houses, are paying out big... Well, you had to buy houses in my day too. Unless they're paying out big sums for housing, there's always more money left over at the end of the week when you pay your bills than there was in my days. So I think today a person is better off than what in my day.
Was credit given from shops to the unemployed? Well, could you owe the shops money?
Yes, you always received a certain amount of credit. I've never known Westie's store to allow credit to go very much. You paid a fortnightly account. Tommy Wiley, when he was in business up there where the shoeys, or where the liquor outlet is today, he was said to have allowed people during the lockout a lot of credit. In fact, I think he allowed them that much that they nearly went broke himself. He never stayed a great length of time. Yes, he did. He stayed there until 1946, Tommy Wiley. But different shopkeepers would allow you to get credit. But I don't think the Westie store allowed you too much credit. They might allow you to go a month, and then they'd stop your credit. But other little shopkeepers, they'd stand you if there was a strike or anything along like that. They'd stand to the people that bought off them.
So how did you feel about people who were on the dole?
Well, I don't know as I could say how I would feel about the people on the dole. I was on the dole myself. To me, I thought it was more or less something that had to be, although I even didn't want it. There was a lowering of a certain amount of dignity, I think. That's the way I felt. Because I was young and strong and had worked up till 31, and I still wanted to work, but there was no work about for you, so we just had to accept it.
How high was unemployment?
Well, the unemployment, according to figures, was up to about 30% during the centre of the Depression, and even when the war first started in 39, now conditions and employment bettered for, we say, 1936 onward. The war started in 39, and even when I think it was 9% were still unemployed throughout Australia. And I am not positive of this, but given time I could get it out of some of my books, I think there were still 260 people registered as unemployed in Westie when the war started. That was 39.
What relief was available and was it enough?
Well, I've got to say no, the relief wasn't enough. Aside from your dole, of course, now when we started working for that, our conditions got very better, much better. Whereas you was receiving 5 and 3 pence when you was getting the docket system, single, 8 and 2 pence married, when you started to work for the dole, it worked out that a married man was getting 31 and 2 pence a fortnight, which in round figures is, we'll say, 16, not quite 16 shillings a week, against your 8. A single man was getting 11 against the 5. Well, as I say, the relief, occasionally, about once every, well, I had it once when I was unemployed there for 3 or 4 years, you'd get a fortnight relief work. Now, that was done on some government project. I put in my fortnight on the canal at Wall's End, and you were paid £3.15 and 2 pence a week. But you never got no dole that week, so you never benefited to a great deal. But occasionally, you would get a pair of pants, a pair of boots, and perhaps an old army military tunic, dyed navy blue. That was issued to the men. The women might occasionally get a pair of shoes, and perhaps a dress length of some material, which they, you know, made up. That was all relief. But they're about the only benefits you could dig up.
What did you think about the question cards that had to be filled in before getting the loot?
Well, the question cards They probed pretty deep into your circumstances. A lot of the questions were, I can remember one question came out. There's a question card came out about 1932, and Jack Lang was a Labor man, he was one of the fellows in charge when they brought it out. Now, it started off, it asked you, or some of the questions asked you, did you own the house you lived in? If the answer was no, do you live with your parents or in-laws? Do you pay rent? Do you have a garden? If not, why not? See? And very probing questions like that, which I don't think it was necessary to know. And it was only adding insult to injury.
What did it feel like to be on the dole?
Well, to feel like to be on the dole. Well, I don't know. Look, it was a dead end. Just a more or less a dead end. You had no chance of getting anything. Practically the clothes you stood up in was all your own. I know for me to get the dole through the father having a few fowls, where the mate went away, we camped at Warner's Bay in a tent. And you can say practically the few clothes we stood up in was all we owned. And I've got to say it was very demoralising, because there was no way out of it. You couldn't see any way out of it, or I couldn't. You just had to accept it till things bettered. But I've got to say the Rothbury March was on the 16th of December 1929. Wally Woods, he was shot in the throat. Norman Brown was killed by police bullets. And there was roughly at least another 50 injured with batons and clubs and bullets.
Did you know any of those people?
Yes, I knew a few of the people that was up there. And this is where I got a lot of information that they were definitely unarmed when they went there. They gave the police, this is the story, no motive to bash them. Well, there was another march in this area, and that went to Astonfield's Colliery, a pit near 4 Mile Creek on the New England Highway. Non-unionists, they were employed there also. Now, the Astonfield March was on the 10th of January 1930. Well, now the men of Westie and Holmesville, Killy, Edgeworth, Spears Point and then Rhonda all gathered here at Westie. Well, about 10 o'clock that night they left. There was two or three of the local town people had lorries, flat tabletop lorries, and one of Johnson's buses. Well, now they filled the lorries up with as many as could get on them in the bus, and they drove them out, we'll say, to Minmai and put them out. In the meantime, the men from Westie had started to walk, and they would probably, we say, a third of the way to Minmai. Well, the lorry came back and got them and took them out as far as the men might have walked from, dropped at Minmai, might have walked another mile further. Well, they'd take the men back then a further mile or two past them and drop them, come back and pick up the next men, or the men they'd put in first. It's hard to explain.
And
they'd drop them further on. Well, finally, by daylight, they were standing there at the railway up to the colliery, where it crossed the New England Highway. Well, now, to keep the police away from Astonfield's, the men at Cessnock put on what they called a dummy run. They all collected there that night, all the thousands of them collected, and the police got wind of it, and they sent police from everywhere. See, they drew police from everywhere. Now these men at Cessnock, they marched in formation down the road and out towards Rothbury Colliery to a place known as Major's Lane, where they stopped, had a bit of a meeting and dispersed. Well, in the meantime the men had got out here to Astonfield from our town here, and there was a lot of funny things happened. Some of them, while they were standing there near the colliery, some of the scabs and non-unionists come driving along in a horse and cart. So they grabbed the men out of the, three men out of the horse and cart. They let the horse go. They burnt the cart and harness. They stripped these three men off naked, then formed up a big long line and they made them run the gauntlet. And the miners were flogging them with switchy, teetery sticks and bushes as they run through it. See?
What was the gauntlet?
Oh, well, just run up between this line of men. That's an old saying, run the gauntlet, way back in some of the old historic days. Well, another fellow come riding along on a motorbike, so they grabbed him and they burnt his motorbike and they stripped him off, and there's a bit of a bridge under the train line. And the water, the big hole, the water looked about, oh, looked deep, but it was very black with coal dirt and that. So after stripping him, they decided to throw him off the bridge into this water hole. But when the poor sod landed, the water, instead of being deep, was only about a foot deep with concrete bottom under the railway bridge. And, things like that went on. They stripped other blokes that came. Well, now, during that episode at the mines, there was a person who had been reared in Westie. His name was Humphreys, Huey Humphreys. And earlier, although he'd been reared with a lot of these fellows and went to school with them, he'd joined the police force. And he was out at one of the few policemen that turned up at Ashtonfirth. He was one of them. Well, he knew a lot of these men that from home, from Westie and that, and he gave them their names to the police, and a lot of these people were fined, summonsed for trespass. Well, now, instead of them being fined under their proper name, they was fined under their nicknames, like we'll say Possum and a fellow named Evans. They used to call him Good Evans, see, his name was Bill. Well, they were all fined under their nicknames. It cost them £2 of 8 bob cost for trespass at Wall's End. In fact, I've got all their names on a piece of paper out there in one of my books. I've never found out yet who paid the fines, but I think the Federation must have. Well, then there was another pit in this area, Little Myall Colliery. That was between Cardiff and Charlestown. You go up the Myall Road and you find a big green water tank on your left hand side going up, and a sports area on your right hand side just past it. Well, the pit was just in behind the sports area. Well, now I was one that marched to Myall, although I didn't go to Rothbury, I went to Ashtonfield. I didn't go to Rothbury. But there was only ever about 20 men employed at Myall, and somewhere or other they got notice that the mob was marching on them. Well, these non-unionists, they run down the pit and they hid in the pit. Well, the manager of the pit, he met the crowd, and there was no violence, there was no nothing. They just milled around and had a meeting, and the manager promised them that the coal filling would stop, and the men just dispersed and went home. That's what for that march. So that the march to Myall Colliery, it took place on the 16th of the 1st, 1930, 6 days after the Ashtonfield mine.
Did they stay convinced?
How did you feel about Jack Lane?
Well, when Jack Lane was first elected, I thought he was going to be Jesus Christ superstar, the saviour of the working class. That's what I thought of Jack Lane. He probably would have been too, but I've got to say the moneyed people refused to, you know, let him any money. Well, anyhow, Jack, he was the Premier of New South Wales, and he was elected in June 1925. Well, what caused a lot of Jack Lang's troubles were he wanted to repudiate all debts owed to England. And anyhow, Lang got the country in such a condition that he was dismissed from office by Sir Philip Game, who was the governor then. But he still did a lot of good for the workers. Two of the things he brought in was he brought in a baby bonus and he brought in a moratorium act about the seizure or confiscation of goods, you know, on higher purchase. Well, now he did a lot of good in those things. Well, now, it was during Jack Lang's, I told you earlier when the bank closed, the dates, and it was during this time when I said my father, he had a few quid in the bank, and when the bank closed, he was allowed to draw his own money at the same rate as he would have drawn dole, 8 and tuppence, as a married man. Well, now, there was one more not chance to be with him, and the old fella, he'd gone into the bank and he'd made his massive withdrawal, 8 and tuppence, and he came out and he was more or less a fellow that never trusted too many people. So he decided that down the footpath he'd check the teller's figures to make sure that when he took a fortnight off, 16 and tuppence, he got not a 16 fortnight, not a
16 pounds.
No, shillings.
16 shillings.
Yes, 16 and tuppence. Oh, fortnight is about 8 and tuppence a week. I'm getting tangled up. And he's checking these figures to make sure that the teller had, you know, not robbed him anyway. And the bloke, a well-dressed sort of a bloke, stepped up to him and he said, "You've got money in the bank." And the old man just looked at him vacantly and he said, "I'll buy your bank balance off you, if you'll sell it, for 10 shillings in the pound." Well, that meant that he'd give the old man 50% of his total in there, see? And it was often advertised in the paper, wanted to buy bank balances. That's how hard people are up. Well, it was, I can assure you I soon told him where to go to, because I was young and big and cheeky at that time. Anyhow, when the bank opened again in 32, my old fella, he went away and I said, "Look, old fella, why don't you draw your money out and put it away somewhere and then apply for the dole?" He said, "They won't give it to me." Well, I said, "They'll answer the question, ask the question, you got any money in the bank?" And I said, "You can truthfully answer no." So he did. About a fortnight later, he went up and he answered the question truthfully. No money in the bank. And finally, they give him his dole. Well, now, that's a lot of conditions, some of the conditions that you had even then. Well, now, it was during Lang's time when the bridge opened, the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Well, there was a fellow there running about the same time, Francis de Groot. Well, now de Groot, he had formed a new movement called the New Guards. Well, this was a fascist movement of the extreme rightists, not the leftists, the extreme rightists. It functioned in two or three places, Germany included. And in fact, we even had some of the clowns come to Westie. And there must have been 30 or 40 in Westie. Formed themselves into what we call, not the New Guards, we call them the Boo Guards up here. And there's a big fight up at the junction of Westie and Midmire Road. That's another story though, forget it. Well, anyhow, it was during the opening of the bridge that de Groot rode up and he cut the ribbon across the bridge. Language just about open it. And I've got a little bit of poetry here. I don't know the author of it, but it's worth reading. This is as it follows. "The day the bridge was opened, I went to see the show, with 24 politicians all sitting in a row. I gazed across the shoulders of a drummer in the band, and I saw Jack Lang standing with the scissors in his hand. The band played Rule Britannia, Happy Days Are Here Again. We all joined in the chorus, led by Sir Philip Game. We gave 3 cheers for Ottie, Ned Kelly and Old Mick. We also gave a raspberry for Jock Gunn and his clique." Well, now Jock Gunn was Lang's right-hand man. But anyway, I'll give you the following verse. "The ribbon across the bridge was waiting to be cut. It wanted just 10 minutes before the time was up. Then up came the major, he galloped to the scene. He raised his sword and with one mighty swipe, he cut the ribbon clean. McKay was very ferocious and he said, "You valley hound." He grabbed a goat by the wishbone and threw him to the ground. A fat lady in the grandstand said, "Oh, you horrid brute." Up came the black Maria, and in went poor De Groot. Well, now, these people mentioned McKay. He was the inspector of the police. Jock Garden was Lang's right-hand man at that time. Well, now, and the bridge, I forgot to go out, it was open on the 19th of 3rd, 1932. Well, I never went to see the opening of it, but I was there within a fortnight or 3 weeks after I had a little old motorbike. A fellow lent me. In fact, he was a cousin. He said, "Here, ride my motorbike down and have a look at it," because I had no money to pay train fees.
Did Jack Lang ever come to Westie or any of the...
Not to my knowledge. I don't think Jack Lang ever came to Westie. He was more or less about Sydney. He used to speak a lot in the domains, or in the domain, and hold, Labour meetings. Oh, I should have said. Now, De Groot and his crowd, if there was a Labour Party meeting on or a rally in the park, De Groot and his crowd would hide amongst the spectators, and at a given time they'd all leave out, and they generally had a matic handle, and they'd start bashing the Labour speakers. And, you know, this thing could have developed into a big thing, because some of the Lang supporters, they formed themselves into what they called the Australian Labour Army. And when De Groot and his supporters would rush out and try to break up the meetings, well, this Australian Labour Army, as the supporters of Lang called themselves, they'd rush out and bash hell out of the De Grooters. But I've got to say, this fascist movement, it got in a pretty big way. They were supposed to have 300,000 followers in Australia, and at one stage, according to a book I have out in my shed, they was prepared, they had an army or a mob of people based at Griffiths, and if Lang got too unruly, they had a more or less this army of people to take over the running of Sydney. But it never got that far. They sacked Lang before it got that far.